We have that there, a link to download either the PDF or the Word format of the outline. You can also go to the live feed section of our website, and there are links there as well for you to download the outline. There's also a link to download the PowerPoint if you'd like to have a copy of the slides there. As we have been studying the book of Romans, we've been going over each week, kind of reviewing what we have studied so far so that we can keep a basic overview of what Paul is saying as we go throughout the book. If you remember, as we were looking in chapter 1, we saw where he was speaking about God's power to save. He was also speaking about the unrighteousness of the Gentiles. As we move into chapter 2, he begins to indict the Jews of their sin and letting them know that they are guilty as well of committing sin just like the Gentiles. In chapter 3, he kind of sums all of that up, and where he says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But by faith in Christ, all can be made righteous. And so it's that faith that we began to focus on in chapter 4. And we used the example of Abraham's faith, or Paul used that example, to show us the type of faith that we as Christians need. And of course, when we read about Abraham and his faith, we see that his faith was one of action. It was one of works. And so we too need to be like Abraham and have a faith that works. In chapter 5, we were looking at the blessings of justification. And there are many great blessings in being justified, both here on earth as well as in heaven. And then we began to look at a comparison between Christ and Adam, and how that Christ was greater than Adam. In chapter 6, we were studying about how that we are slaves of righteousness, that no longer are we slaves of sin. We are no longer under the dominion of sin, but we have become slaves of righteousness. And so today we will begin in chapter 7, and we will see how that the law brings knowledge of sin. As we study chapter 7, we need to keep in mind those things that we saw in the previous chapter, in chapter 6. Among those things, we need to not forget that when one is baptized into the death of Christ, the old man of sin is crucified, and he is thereby made free from the rule of sin. And so as we just stated, we are no longer under the dominion of sin. And of course, this is something that is going to be necessary for us to keep in our minds as we go through chapter 7, because if we don't, we might get confused about some of the things that Paul is stating there. We also need to remember that those who are raised with Christ no longer allow sin to reign in their lives, but instead serve righteousness. And so it's important for us, therefore, to understand that we no longer sin. We no longer commit sin on a daily basis, and when we do, we must make correction of that, get forgiveness of that, and then endeavor to no longer sin again. We also need to remember that sin does not have dominion over the saved, but they are under grace and not law. And we saw this in chapter 6 and verse 14. When one becomes a Christian, he is entering a new life free from the slavery of sin. And so this is a new direction that we walk when we become Christians. It's a new walk. It's a walk in faith like that of Abraham, as we just mentioned. And so the question that the Romans may have been asking at this point in the book is, how exactly are they supposed to lead this new life? How exactly are they to walk this new path that Paul was encouraging them to do? Is this going to be guided by the law? Is it going to be guided by the gospel? Is it going to be guided by some combination of both the law and the gospel? And so this is probably a question they were asking. And so in chapter 7, Paul begins to answer that question, and he is going to answer it in 7, as well as continue to deal with that throughout other parts of the book of Romans as well. And so as we study chapter 7, we need to understand, or we need to remember, that it immediately follows chapter 6. We may struggle a little bit with what Paul is stating in chapter 7, struggle with maybe what it means. And it will help us to remember to look at the broader picture, to look back and look at this book as just that. It's a letter. Paul did not divide the book of Romans up into chapters. That was done by men in order to help us better study and to navigate the book. When Paul wrote it, it was one continuous letter, and so there were no divisions. Paul did not put that number 7 there to divide between chapter 6 and 7. And so we need to take that in consideration as we go throughout the entire book of Romans, but especially when we get to some of these more difficult passages. And if we consider the flow of the book, if we look back and see what Paul is trying to state in other parts of the book, and kind of, as we said, view the whole book as, you know, the bigger picture, I think that will help us to understand some of these more difficult passages. One of the biggest mistakes that we can make in our study of Romans, as well as in our study of any part of the Bible, is to not take into account the context of the passage. And so it's very important for us to consider the context, because much can be learned by looking at, you know, things that were said both previous and following maybe a particular passage that we are endeavoring to understand. And so that is what we will try to do as we go throughout chapter 7, as well as throughout the entire book, is to look at these things and look at them within the context of what was going on there. And so we will focus on chapter 7 today, and we will do so with a view to the whole book and with a view to the broader message that Paul is trying to get across in writing this letter to the church there in Rome. And, you know, I was going to give an example of one thing that we might get confused about. And if you look at verse 14 of chapter 7, and Paul says there, "For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin." And so we take this passage and we take it and we start trying to figure that out without consideration to the previous chapter. We may very well come up with the wrong conclusion. And many people do. They will take this particular scripture and they will come up with a conclusion that really doesn't fit with the book as a whole. So we shouldn't just read this passage or any passage casually and try to figure out its meaning without looking at the context. Because when we back up into chapter 6 and read verse 12, it says, "Therefore do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you shall obey it in its lust." And so, you know, in chapter 7 and verse 14, just reading that one verse, it seems that Paul is allowing sin to reign. He says, "But I am carnal. I'm sold under sin." But just previous to that, a few verses up, he says, "Do not allow sin to reign in your body." And so we've got to understand this. We've got to understand, well, what is he actually saying, so that we can better understand the book. And so, as we've said before, one of the first things that we might need to do when we're wrestling with a particular passage is to figure out what he's not saying. And so as we read verse 14, and, you know, after we have already studied chapter 6, then we know that he's not saying that sin is reigning within his body. He's not saying that he's under the dominion of sin. And so at that point, we can then try to figure out, well, what is he saying? And so this is a common method that good Bible scholars have in trying to determine what a particular passage means. And then we can go past chapter 7 and look in chapter 8 in verse 6. It says, "For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace." And so, definitely, if we look at the preceding verses as well as those that come after chapter 7, then we know that Paul is not condoning a life where you're living under the dominion of sin. And so all of these things are very important as we study this chapter. We also must understand who he is speaking to. And I'm not making this point in an effort to say that this passage is only applies to a specific group of people. When we understand who he's speaking to, then it gives us a better idea of maybe the meaning of what he's trying to get across. You know, truth is applicable to everyone, And if he is dispensing truth in a particular passage, then that truth is going to be applicable to me, you, and everyone who reads it. But in order to understand the point he's trying to get across, the truth that he's trying to give to us, it helps to understand who he's speaking to. When you look in verse 1 of chapter 7, you know, what clue there do we have who he's speaking to? It says there, "Do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law." And so here, Paul is speaking to those who know the law. What group of people in particular would be very familiar with the law? Of course, we know that would be the Jews. The Jews would be the most familiar with the law of any nation on earth at that time. And so it seems that as he's beginning chapter 7, that he's beginning to speak to the Jews, the Jewish Christians in particular. And so when we understand that, and then we begin to think about, well, what's one of the largest hurdles that the Jewish Christian had to get over as they now are converting to a life under Christ, to a life of serving Christ? And when we think about that, you know, obviously, as we read this book, as well as other books that we've studied, the book of Acts in particular, letting go of the old law was a huge struggle for many of the Jewish Christians. If we look back in Acts chapter 15, we have studied that previously just a few months ago. And there in verse 5, we see the struggle. It says, "But some of the sect of the Pharisees who believed rose up, saying, it is necessary to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses." And so here we see that some of the sect of the Pharisees, and these were Pharisees who believed. And so these are believing Christians. But these Christians, these Jewish Christians, were struggling with letting go of the old law. They were trying to command people that they had to be circumcised as well as keep the old law. And so this struggle, to borrow a phrase from popular culture, the struggle was real. It was very real for these people that had lived for centuries under the law, to let go of that law, and therefore to be under this new covenant, this new law under Christ. And so this was a struggle that they had. And so Paul is dealing in some parts of this book with that struggle. And we can read about this struggle in the book of Romans. We can read about it in the book of Acts. We can read about it in other places in the New Testament as well. And so the law simply just did not disappear in a very physical way, as well as in the minds of the Jewish Christians. It was a process that they had to come to understand that they are no longer under that law that really guided every aspect of their life from their from not only their spiritual laws, but the physical laws as well. The laws of their nation were also guided by this old law. And so this was a struggle that they had in converting over to Christianity. So a big question that the Jews might have had, the question that was in their minds might have been, well, how is all of this going to work out? How is this going to come about? Or realistically, how are we going to do this? How are we going to begin following this new covenant? And so in chapter 7, Paul begins by addressing the Jewish Christian and their relationship to the law. He begins with a parallel to marriage. And so let's read the first three verses of chapter 7. It says, "Or do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law, that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, if, while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man." And so here Paul is speaking to Christians who had come out of Judaism, and he appeals to their knowledge of the law. He says, "I'm speaking to those who know the law." He uses marriage here as an example to prove a point. And so when we look at this process or this this method of using an example, maybe we might call it an illustration, we see that he's taking something that is very familiar in order to help them understand something that is not as familiar or maybe is more difficult for them to understand. And so what Paul is doing here in this passage is not speaking on marriage, so to say. He's speaking on marriage in order to prove a point about something that is less familiar. You know, all of these people clearly, obviously understood the laws concerning marriage. And so he's taking those laws and he's trying to prove a point here. The sad thing is that many today do not possess the same understanding as far as the laws of marriage. And so the simplicity of this point is lost on many people today because there is so much false doctrine being taught on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. But for someone who is familiar with the law, this idea of till death do we part, it went without saying. It was something that was just accepted. As long as your spouse lives, the marriage contract is binding. What frees you from that contract would be death. Trying to enter into a relationship with another before the death of your spouse would be considered adultery. And so all of these things went without saying. And so I don't plan really to get into a discussion of marriage and divorce. I don't think that's the point necessarily of this chapter. We can learn some things about marriage and divorce in this chapter, but that's not necessarily the purpose of the point that Paul was trying to get across here in the broader sense as we study the book of Romans. But we see, you know, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 in verse 39. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives, but if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. And so we see that, you know, even in the New Testament, the same principle was upheld. Now we have the one exception there in Matthew 19 and verse 9, but there again, we're not really going to get into that this evening. The focus of this passage is not husbands and wives. It's the Jews and the law, the Jews and their relationship to the law. So let's not lose sight of the point that Paul was really trying to get across in bringing up this idea of a husband and wife marrying and one dying and being loose from the bond there. Let's not lose sight of the point that what Paul was trying to get across. The parallel is drawn to illustrate how law has dominion over those who live under it. As we read there in verse 1, the last part of verse 1, it says, the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. So the law had dominion over the Jews as long as it was in effect, as long as it lived. You look at Colossians chapter 2, verses 13 and 14. It says, and you being dead in your trespasses and uncircumcision of your flesh, he has made alive together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which is contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. So the old law has been taken out of the way. It has been nailed to the cross. It has been crucified to the cross with Christ. And so it is no longer in effect. But not only had the old law been done away with, the Jewish Christians had died to the law. They themselves had died to the old law. You look in Romans chapter 7, as we continue reading there, we'll pick up in verse 4. It says, therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be married to another. So here they had become dead so that they could be married to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that we should bear fruit to God. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit to death. But now we have been delivered from the law, having died to what we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. And so now they had died to the law, and so now they could be married to Christ. Death breaks the bond so that a new relationship can be entered into without condemnation. We read verse 4 there. The first part of verse 4 says, "Therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be married to another." And so they had died to the law. That bond to the law was broken at death, and so now they could be married to Christ. The implication is that a woman cannot be in a relationship with two men at the same time. And so if you have either a man or a woman that is in a relationship with two people, then that is considered adultery. That's physical adultery. Only death is one of the ways. We mentioned the other in Matthew 19:9, the other condition. But death is what severs that bond and allows him to enter into a new relationship. When they died with Christ in baptism, their bond to the law was broken. It was no longer in effect. That relationship was severed. They became free to enter into a new relationship with Christ. They would not be guilty of spiritual adultery by entering into this new relationship. Yet, by the same token, it was not possible for them to enter into this new relationship with Christ, but yet continue to keep part of the old law or bind part of the old law to other people. That would be the same as being married to one man and then having a relationship with another man simultaneously. You just cannot do that. It would be spiritual adultery. In writing to the Galatians, Paul says in Galatians chapter 2, verses 19 and 20, "For I, through the law, died to the law that I might live to God. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me." And so here, Paul reiterates this same concept of no longer living under the law. He lives for Christ. You know, Christ was the one that died for us, so now we are living for Christ. We are living this new relationship. They can now serve in newness of the Spirit, which is far superior to serving in the oldness of the letter, so to speak. You look in verse 6 of Romans chapter 7. It says, "But now we have been delivered from the law, having died to what we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter." So here we see the two covenants contrasted. The old law was ritualistic. It only exposed sin. It did not provide a true remedy for sin. The new law was more spiritual in nature. Obedience from the heart is required. This new covenant makes provisions for man's weakness by supplying the grace needed to remove sin permanently, something that the old law couldn't do. And so now these Jewish Christians were free to serve in this new law. And it was such a greater place to be. And so Paul is going to continue to expand upon this throughout this chapter as well as throughout the remaining part of the book of Romans. Speaking of the law in these terms naturally led the Jews to ask some questions. And so Paul now goes on to explain that the law wasn't sinful. As we pick up reading there in verse 7 of Romans 7, it says, What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law has said, you shall not covet. But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me. Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just, and good. And so we see that the law did not cause them to sin. What the law did is it revealed their actions as being sin. The law did not cause Paul to covet. It helped him understand what his actions really were. It revealed to him that this desire to have something that did not belong to him was covetousness. And so it revealed that to him. Covetousness existed before the law. It simply was not yet defined as sin. You know, it's like sometimes we hesitate to share the gospel with our neighbors and friends because we don't want to reveal to them that their actions or maybe their mode of life is sinful. And so we hesitate in doing that. But because does that make their actions not sinful? No, they're sinful and they need to know about that. And so that's what the law did. The law revealed the actions that the Jews and others were doing as being sin. It did not cause them to sin. We understand that it's not the law is not the problem. The gospel is not the problem today. It's man. We are the problem and our desires. The problem lies within the person who is committing the sin, whether it's done willingly or out of ignorance. Divine law does not produce sin, but sin uses the law to stir within us desires to go against God's will. We see in this passage that sin is personified. He uses this method of writing in order to better illustrate how sin works within us to stir up these evil passions. You know what? How many times have we been attracted to something simply because we could not have it? You know, sometimes certain things never hold any appeal to us at all until we are told that we can't have it. And then, at that point, we can think about nothing else but trying to get that simply because it's not available to us. It's like a rebellious teenager doing something just to go against maybe the authority of their parents or the authority of the government or something like that. They just want to do something that they're being told not to do. So, you know, you think about, would the fruit of the tree of knowledge have been so desirable to Eve if it had not been forbidden to her? And I don't think maybe it would have. It was that forbidden fruit that she wanted. She wanted it because, you know, of course she was deceived, but oftentimes we want things just because we can't have them. It's a story as old as time. You know, Paul recognizes this as a human trait. You look in verse 8, it says, "But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desires, for apart from the law, the sin was dead." Sin and our attraction to it is what produced these evil desires. This was not the result of the law in and of itself. The law labeled this as sin. But then our evil desires then produced, you know, this are produced in me all manner of evil desires. It was this attitude of I want what I can't have. And so I believe that is what Paul is getting at here. He also says that where there is no law or apart from the law, there can be no sin. And so where, you know, we can't break a law that doesn't exist. And so in order for us to break a law, then there has to be a law. If there's no law, then there's no sin. We also see in verse 9 that there was a time when Paul was alive without the law. He says there, "I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died." And so we ask the question, well, when was this? When was Paul alive without the law? I believe he's speaking about before he was accountable, before he had reached the age of accountability. A child before the age of accountability is pure and innocent. They are alive without law because they are too young to be held responsible for violating the law. You look at how Christ spoke of children in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 14. It says, "But Jesus said, let the little children come to me and do not forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." In what way does Christ desire the kingdom of heaven to be like children? It is to be alive and sinless, like a little child. This concept is spoken of by Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 39. He says there, "Moreover, your little ones and your children, who you say will be victims, who today have no knowledge of good and evil, they shall go in there. To them I will give it, and they shall possess it." And so here, if we understand or if we are familiar with the book of Deuteronomy, here Paul is speaking to the children of, or not Paul, Moses is speaking to the children of Israel before they go in to possess the land. Or he's recounting all the events that had happened before they go in to possess the land. And so the children of Israel had sinned against God by saying that they could not defeat those who were already in the land. And so at that point, God was very angry with them, and he made them wander in the wilderness. But we see here that the little ones were not held responsible for that sin because they had no knowledge of good and evil. They didn't have sufficient knowledge to always make proper decisions. And I believe this is the concept that Paul is talking about here, talking about how that he was alive without the law. But ultimately, the commandment comes, and with it, maturity and understanding. We become old enough to understand the commandments of God and the implications of breaking those commandments. And so it is at this point that sin becomes alive. It begins to live within us. This is when we know to do right, yet we do the opposite. We look back in Romans chapter 7, verses 9 through 11. It says, "Sin revived, and I died. And the commandment which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me." We allow ourselves to be deceived by sin, and we therefore suffer this spiritual death. The law is not sinful, and it does not force, it does not cause people to sin. You know, Paul states in verse 11 that sin deceived him. He was deceived by sin. It wasn't the law's fault that he had committed sin. It was his fault for being deceived by sin. The law is holy and just. You look in Romans chapter 7 and verse 12. It says, "Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good." And then we read Psalms chapter 19, verses 7 through 11. It says, "The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward." So the law is holy. It's just. It wasn't a mistake. It was what God had planned. And so we see that it wasn't the fault of the law that the Jewish nation sinned. Sin used the law and through deceit caused each person to violate the law and therefore die spiritually. You look in James chapter 1, verses 13 and 14. It says, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by the law. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed." And so this is what causes us to sin. When we are drawn away by our own desires and we're enticed by this sin, therefore to go against the commandments that we have been given. And so in conclusion of our study this evening, we see that the law did not create sin. The law brought knowledge of sin. It defined sin. It allowed those under the law to understand what sin was. The blame for sin rests fully on the shoulders of the one who commits sin. If we are of an accountable age, the responsibility for our sins rests within each one of us. It is not inherited from Adam. It is not caused by the law. We allow ourselves to be deceived. We allow ourselves to be drawn away by our own desires, and therefore we commit sin. And so, Lord willing, next Sunday evening, we will try to finish up the last half of the chapter 7 in the book of Romans. We invite you to join us again on Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock as Brother Hall will continue to study with us there in the studies that he has prepared. If you would like to get the outline for that study, we will try to make that available probably by tomorrow evening. We will get that posted there on the live feed of our website, so you can go there and download that outline and be looking at that prior to the study. But we thank you again for joining us this evening, and we hope to have you with us again soon.